Two and a Half Admins, episode 253. I'm Joe.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Alan.
And here we are again. Before we get started, your customary article plug, Alan, is ZFS Performance Tuning, optimizing for your workload.
Yeah, so in this article, we walk through some of the basics of ZFS Performance Tuning, how ZFS is different from a regular file system, some of the complexity of metadata traversal and what you can do about it, the implications of RAID Z, and basically how to tune for throughput versus IOPS, and latency, and all the basic principles of performance.
Right, well, link in the show notes as usual. We've talked about Bcache.fs quite a lot before, and they recently had a bit of an embarrassing bug that has now been fixed, but that led you to post on Mastodon, Jim.
It's starting to get a little concerning to me that we're seeing so many attempts at next-gen file systems struggling at least and failing if you're not feeling particularly charitable. And it's not just in the open source community. We look at, you know, Microsoft failed so hard with refs, you know, it's REFS. I actually had to go Google it to remind myself of the name because I hadn't even seen anybody say anything about it in years because of failure to implement enough features for it to actually function as a root file system on Windows or even as a file system that hosts, you know, many standard applications like Microsoft SQL Server on Windows. Then you've got, you know, all the issues that we've lamented to a great degree about, you know, butter on the show. And, you know, we look at Bcache now has been, you know, floundering quite a bit. You know, we've got this data loss bug. We've had, you know, Overstreet getting yelled at for, you know, Linus about just the dev style and the ability to, you know, coordinate with the greater kernel project. And it makes me wonder if next-gen file systems are approaching some kind of inherent human mental limit in modeling and managing complexity, because, you know, this is something that has been done at least twice already. You know, I mean, we've got ZFS, we've got NetApp's Waffle. These systems both do most of the same types of things in similar enough ways that we had to settle a patent lawsuit over it a couple of decades ago. But nobody else seems to be managing it. And I have to question, why not?
Well, part of it might be, you know, in the case of Bcache.fs, this is maybe a little too much for one person to do in their head at once, like to do all the bits of this. I don't know that much about the internals of Bcache.fs, but from my understanding, it doesn't actually try to break it up into components like ZFS does. ZFS has all these separate layers, like the VDEV layer, the ZIO, the DMU, etc. And those are kind of implemented by separate teams so that no one person had to try to keep the complexity of all of ZFS in their head at once. There were well-defined interfaces where things pass off between the different components. Whereas Bcache.fs seems to be mostly kind of a one-man project. Like there's multiple people working on it, but it's mostly driven by a single person. And maybe that's part of the problem, but even thinking to the stories back to around the beginning of ZFS, ZFS was Sun's like fourth attempt to write a new file system. But part of the problem they had was each of those projects kind of started and then very quickly entered scope creep and having, oh, well, we should also do this and do this and trying to do too many things at once with too many different people and kind of too many cooks in the kitchen. And so ZFS only succeeded because they narrowed it down and started the project with one senior person and one grad student that didn't know better and had them redesign everything from scratch, but then brought in teams of people to actually go and do the building of it. So I don't know that it's so much that it all conceptually can't be understood, but it probably is a lot to ask for any one person to know all of the pieces.
So what's Microsoft's excuse?
Their excuse, if you watch the video that Dave Plummer did about it recently on YouTube, is that, you know, they were trying to have a embedded SQL database in the file system to keep track of all kinds of like attributes and tags on the files so that you could do what you can do now, where you like search and show me all pictures that say they have a dog in them or whatever. But back before we had anything like machine learning that could look at pictures and tell you if there's a dog in it or not, they really assumed people were going to go through and manually add all these tags and metadata to all of these things. But I don't know why they decided to do it the way they did rather than something that looks a bit more like extended attributes, because yeah, they seem to make it way too complicated and way too slow right off the bat and then just got worse from there. But you know, we do think about this a lot in ZFS, you know. Oftentimes, when we're looking at a new feature, it's like, is this going to be so complex that it makes it harder to add any other new feature to ZFS in the future? Everybody's at some point wished that there was block pointer rewrite in ZFS, and we could probably do it and create that feature, but it might complicate the ZFS code so much that it would be the last feature to ever get added to ZFS, because nobody can wrap their head around all the implications to try to add the next thing after it.
It sounds like you're saying I'm right, and we're definitely approaching a limit to the human ability to model complex systems.
Yes, and I think that's why it's important that you have the kind of breakdown in the layers and so on, so that you can have smaller pieces that somebody can actually reason about. But at the same time, you can't have so many that, you know, the complexity, it turns into a giant distributed system or something. So yeah, I think there are limits. I don't think ZFS is doomed or anything, but it is complicated. And I just feel like every other file system's biggest problem now is it's going to be measured against ZFS, which had a 25-year head start.
And it had billions of dollars spent on it, would you say?
Sun definitely put in hundreds of engineer years of effort. And so I don't know what the cost of that was, but definitely a lot.
Well, you figure most likely 100 engineer years is probably pretty close to 10 million. So depending on how many hundreds of developer years, you're not really talking about getting very close to a billion, let alone billions.
But nevertheless, they spent a lot of money on it.
I mean, it depends on scale. We haven't even broken a billion, which means, you know, on like a nation state scale, it's nothing. Even on the scale of some individual's personally held wealth, it's dig and change out of the couch cushions. So I don't think we can really blame it on money.
No, a lot of it is literally just nobody's got 25 years and 100 people to go and try to build something as good as ZFS in, you know, 5 years or whatever that most of these competitors have really had. Well, I guess ButterFS has had 15 years at this point, haven't they?
Yeah, yeah. It's probably worth pointing out that in addition to being complex and expensive, one issue in terms of mounting, you know, the kind of major effort at accomplishing a really serious milestone that a nation or a very large corporation, you know, might otherwise tackle, is we're not really in a portion of history that seems to be very interested in the long term.
Mm.
I feel like that's pretty safe to say. And I think it's also pretty safe to say that, you know, apart from weirdos like me and Alan, most people find file systems about as unsexy as any part of a computer operating system can possibly be. It's not something that's going to get investors excited. It's not something that, you know, it doesn't throw up beautiful images that you can put on a billboard. It doesn't write text. It doesn't talk to you and pretend to be your dead meemaw or whatever. You know, it's just file systems, just the thing that stores your files. Now, is it critically, fundamentally important to computing? Yes, more so than just about any other kind of code. And that's why personally, I've always found file systems inordinately interesting, because I can see how foundational and necessary they are. But most people don't think that way. So in addition to the complexity and the difficulty of just holding it all in, you know, the human brain at once, maybe we're just kind of missing that collective will to accomplish something that's needful, but isn't necessarily, I hate to overuse the word, but, you know, quote unquote, sexy.
Well, is that because older generation file systems are just good enough for most people? Whereas ZFS is like more than a file system to me. It is kind of the underlying file system, but it's also the features that are built on top of that. Whereas you look at NTFS or EXT4, they are like perfectly fine file systems.
I think that's reasonably fair to say, but again, part of the problem with, you know, is it good enough or not is, you know, what are you used to? What are you interested in? And a lot of people, even just on an individual scale, I think that normal people don't really look several years ahead to a catastrophe that they're going to want to avoid, you know? And a lot of the appeal for ZFS, to me, certainly, you know, what got me into it to begin with, it wasn't, you know, the inline compression, it wasn't replication, it wasn't even snapshots, it was the per block checksumming. The fact that we don't have at least that in like every single file system out there absolutely blows my mind. Because, you know, as an IT professional, by the time ZFS came around, I had already seen, you know, innumerable amounts of data loss, you know, due to just various failures and corruption, whether it be, you know, at the hardware level or the software level or what have you. And when I saw Jeff Bonwick's blog post about how he screwed up in, you know, a machine that he had a two-drive mirror in and hadn't paid attention to it for 6 months and discovered like 100,000 checksum errors with no data lost, I was like, at that point, I assumed that that file system would have to be just an absolute performance dog, which of course is not the case. But I figured it would have to be. And nevertheless, my question was not how much of a dog is it, you know, so much as just like, how can I have it? Like, okay, I'm assuming it's going to be anywhere from half the speed to a tenth the speed of a normal file system, but I still want it. And so then when I got it and I discovered that, no, I'm not seeing any performance bottlenecks introduced at all in my workloads, it was just like, my God, why is anybody ever doing anything different?
Yeah, I suppose you're right. Even if you don't get into data sets and sending snapshots around, just dump stuff in the root of it. That's still way better than dumping it in the root of an ext4 because of the checksumming and the scrubs every month.
And the fact that it can combine more than one disk and intelligently use them. If you want to have two disks on an ext4, you need a whole other tool to first make one fake disk out of your two disks and then build an ext4 on top of it. And because it doesn't have checksums, that dumb tool that does the mirroring for you or the RAID isn't going to be able to tell which of those two is corrupted and not be able to fix it like ZFS can.
That's the answer as to why the MD RAID or LVM, whichever way you want to look at it, both really, why those layers need to be a part of the ZFS stack, which of course is one of the things that pissed off a lot of, you know, very old school, you know, Unix philosophy Linux heads. They hated collapsing that stack into, you know, one single thing, ZFS. But that's the reason why that needed to happen, to have those features. But again, even before you get into all that, I would say the snapshots are the next logical thing. And in fact, that was the next thing that, you know, really I discovered. I'm like, well, this is so super useful. I can take a snapshot, have, you know, an exact immutable point in time if something catastrophic happens. Like, for example, on this very dodgy software upgrade I'm about to, you know, try, and I don't trust the vendor who wrote it, knowing, well, hey, I can take a snapshot first, and then I can roll back to it immediately. That's also huge. And like, once you have it, it's really, really hard to go back. But again, if we're talking about normal people, well, normal sysadmins will recognize the value of a snapshot really quickly once they're introduced to it. But sysadmins already aren't normal humans. And I think arguably, you know, sysadmins who are really, truly interested in storage the way that Alan and I, and honestly at this point, even Joe are, that's not, in my experience, very sysadmin normal either. So we're starting to get into kind of a vanishingly small percentage of people that actually care about this stuff, despite how critically important it is.
Yeah, but then again, if you show users the previous versions feature of their network share that's backed by ZFS and then take it away from them, they'll suddenly care about it a little bit. But the other one I found interesting is the only relatively new kind of next-gen file system that has ever come out and actually succeeded is Apple's APFS. And they kind of started going down the road of something ZFS-like and then cut all of the features out. So they have checksumming, but only on the metadata, not the data. And then they have a little bit like something like datasets and cloning, but they kept, you know, just to the bare minimums for what they needed. So it seems it can be done, but I've just not seen any other examples beyond Apple's, and Apple, you know, kind of purposely did just the bare minimum for what they needed and wasn't actually trying to have anything, you know, like feature parity with ZFS.
Well, I mean, obviously it can be done. NetApp did it without much of anybody coming before them, to the best of my knowledge. ZFS did it with NetApp as an example, but, you know, no access to the code. Apple now has access to everything. Microsoft had access to everything. And that's two of the largest players in IT on the planet now that have tried and, depending on how you want to look at it, either failed miserably or decided, you know, a tenth of the way into it, you know what? We don't want to bother investing in this. And given the degree of unoriginality we're talking about now, you know, with both NetApp's example and Sun's example, and now, you know, OpenZFS, you know, continuing on in Sun's footsteps, I find it concerning. I guess it's also just plain interesting. It doesn't feel like we've really run up against something that feels like, okay, maybe we really can't get much further than this because we're just not bright enough.
Yeah, like I don't think we're actually there. What's interesting is kind of to Joe's point earlier that a lot of people aren't that interested in file systems. And, you know, we've talked about this on the show before, you know, quote, kids these days don't really even know what a file system is. They don't save their files in a directory structure, let alone worried about drives and different data sets. They just save files in, quote, an application or the cloud or whatever. And even taking a file from one application and opening it in a different one generally requires using the kind of share feature on your locked down device rather than just browsing to a specific directory on your file system and opening it.
Mm.
Where's the next generation of engineers that are going to work on this stuff going to come from when most of a generation now doesn't even understand the real concept of directories and so on?
I'm not sure that's entirely relevant here because, I mean, honestly, you're talking about normies. By the time you become even a dev, let alone a sysadmin, you have to know what a file system is. You have to work with files at the file level.
Do you? Have you seen a lot of applications that just put everything in an SQLite database or something and don't touch the file system?
I mean, sure, but that's a choice. And even to work with that SQLite database, you had to be aware there's a file system and put files someplace in order to be able to work with it.
I do wonder if there's devs using some sort of IDE that just has all the files within the IDE and they don't even have the concept of a file system. They all just live within a project within that IDE. I don't know.
I have made a lot of in good fun, you know, disparaging comments of devs, you know, with the understanding that I don't actually mean it. And it's just kind of, you know, giving back the same energy that, you know, we sysadmins tend to get back from developers. Developers largely think that sysadmins are brain dead devs, like you weren't bright enough to dev, so you sysadmin instead. And of course, that's completely unfair. But my point is, of all of the manifold failings that I have either publicly or privately, or at least in the privacy of my own head, complained about with software developers, I have yet to meet a professional software developer who doesn't understand the basics of file systems in terms of like change directory, make directory, touch a file. It's pretty uncommon to find a dev of the caliber that you would find even just randomly attending a technical conference who won't immediately know exactly what you mean if you say stat a file, which is way beyond just like having the basic idea of where files go and what a file system is.
I hope you're right, but I fear you might be wrong about some of the younger ones.
I mean, you know, it kind of sounds like you're doing the 2.5 admins version of Jimmy Kimmel's, you know, man on the street interviews, where he puts somebody, you know, out on the road and literally just on a sidewalk waiting for the stupidest possible people to come by so that when he asks the most blatantly obvious questions, you know, the last 100 people were all just like, what? Here's the answer. But, you know, that one moron, that's the one that goes on the show.
Mm.
It kind of feels like you're taking that Jimmy Kimmel route here. I mean, can you find somebody who calls themselves a developer who has never left an IDE and doesn't really understand where all the files are? Probably. Has that person ever made any software that anybody else who's not related to them or is dating them has heard of? I'm going to say probably not.
Yeah, there's just a risk of the opposite of, you know, the selection bias of, you know, you mostly talk to the type of developers that go to technical conferences that you would go to. And so, of course, they know what the stat syscall is.
I mean, I've also been to Microsoft Ignite several times, and that's not something that I would normally go to personally, but, you know, I worked for Ars Technica, so I covered it. And, you know, I'm not going to say anything disparaging about those folks going to Ignite. And those are the corporatist, you know, Windows-only dev-type devs you're likely to meet. But even then, by the time you find somebody who's even just so much as willing to go to a conference, no. And now, are those people generally head and shoulders above the devs who don't bother doing things like going to the occasional conference? I would say yes. But again, I mean, I've worked with a lot of developers for a very long time, and I have yet to meet one who wouldn't understand what I meant when I say stat a file. Maybe one or two that wouldn't understand stat, but I could literally explain it instantly, just look at the metadata on the file. Oh, okay. And they're fully on board, fully up to where we need to be at that point.
Before we close this out, I think it is worth saying this, that we're not trying to say ZFS is the king and no one can ever touch it and we don't want anything to ever touch it. We're saying that we are worried that there won't be another project that can rival ZFS, and that is a bad thing. It would be great if there was something that was as good or better than ZFS so that we had a choice.
I want two different alternatives that are every bit as good as OpenZFS tomorrow, please. Joe's correct. None of this was in any way an attempt to just be like, oh, isn't ZFS so amazing, blah, blah, blah. It's a look, I'm concerned for the future of the industry because this is really foundational technology. It's really important, and it's worrying that nobody seems to be successfully replicating that. You know, a successful project, especially a successful open source project, it should have forks. It should have copycats. It should have, you know, direct competitors. And Butter is the only thing that you can even vaguely keep a straight face and say is competing with OpenZFS. Again, outside of, you know, sure, Waffle, if you want to buy a NetApp SAN, but we ought to be seeing these concepts going a lot further than they have.
Yeah, you know, monocultures are bad, right? There should be more than one operating system we use. Like, Linux can't be everything. That's why you need things like FreeBSD, even if it was first.
That's why we needed Linux.
Yeah.
Okay, this episode is sponsored by people who support us with PayPal and Patreon. Go to 2.5admins.com/support for details of how you can support us too. Patreon supporters have the option to listen to episodes without ads like this. And it's not just this show. There's Late Night Linux for news, discoveries, audience input, and misanthropy. Linux Matters for upbeat family-friendly adventures. Linux After Dark for silly challenges and philosophical debates. Linux Dev Time about developing with and for Linux. Hybrid Cloud Show for everything public and private cloud. And Ask the Hosts for off-topic questions from you. You can even get some episodes a bit early. We've got a lot going on, and it's only possible because of the people who support us. So if you like what we do and can afford it, it would be great if you could support us too at 2.5admins.com/support. Let's do some free consulting then. But first, just a quick thank you to everyone who supports us with PayPal and Patreon. We really do appreciate that. And if you want to send any questions for Jim and Alan or your feedback, you can email show@2.5admins.com. Charles writes, what do you think of Fresh Tomato or any third-party firmware for home routers? Do you think that replacing the firmware provided by an OEM is a good idea with home routers?
Yeah, I think in general, like replacing what the OEM gave you with something open source is often going to be better. You're going to get more performance out of it. More of the memory will be actually used for your NAT state table. It means you'll have to reboot it less often and so on.
Maybe.
Yes.
Maybe. Test it.
Yeah, it'll depend on the firmware. And, you know, these firmware will have a long list of different devices they support. Some of those it will support really well, and some of them less so. So it is a bit of a mixed bag. But if you have a problem with what the OEM is giving you, it's a good thing to try. If it's not broke, you know, maybe you don't need to fix it. But oftentimes it can be better. But if you're going to go that far, at some point it's like, stop buying the OEM stuff and build your own thing instead. And we've covered that plenty of times on the show.
Yeah, speaking as the admin of the three of us who has by far done the most actual, careful, professional benchmarking of consumer networking devices, I can tell you that unfortunately, the third-party firmware usually underperforms compared to the OEM. There are some counterexamples, but Tomato is actually a really good example of this. Tomato looks incredibly good when you install it. It has all the knobs and sliders and buttons and tuning, this and that and the other that you wish was there in your OEM firmware, but wasn't. And it makes you feel real good and real advanced because, you know, look at this super shiny, all the knobs and sliders on it thing that you have in your router. Unfortunately, when you actually test its performance in a reasonable simulation of a fairly busy home network, it almost never performs as well as the OEM firmware did, unless you just had a particularly like buggy single release, like right then that was the most current of your OEM firmware, not usually a performance win. Now, with that said, you're not always after performance as like, you know, your top thing in a router. You know, maybe that's not your big bottleneck. Maybe you're not as concerned about that. Maybe, you know, getting a feature like, for example, static routing, you know, that might not have been present in your, you know, OEM build. Maybe that's important enough to you that it's worth running something like Tomato, in which case, knock yourself out. But I don't think there are any real panaceas in like, oh, I'm sure this will be better now that you've installed the third-party firmware. I think the closest thing to that would be, you know, devices that are extremely well supported by the OpenWrt project. You can usually pretty much bank that in that case, the OpenWrt firmware for that router is probably going to outperform the OEM, or at the very least hang like right there neck and neck with it in those cases where the OEM firmware actually is just skinned OpenWrt itself. But yeah, the other option, and Alan did allude to this as well, you know, if you're really into all the advanced bells and whistles and sliders and feeling like you've got a better thing than everybody else has, then yeah, consider building your own. It's certainly possible to do. And you actually can get improved performance and security out of that. Now, it's not necessarily going to be easy. It's not necessarily going to be pretty when you're done. But if what you really want is better performance and more features, yeah, you can't beat rolling your own.
Now, I know that we're talking about routers, but my understanding is that whenever Wi-Fi gets involved, you are generally better off with the OEM software because of driver issues and stuff like that.
Because the OEM is likely working with the people who made the Wi-Fi to have it work as well as possible. And that's kind of to Jim's point. The OEM is trying to get their device to look like it has the best possible numbers. You know, they put quite a bit of effort into tuning it. Whereas something like Tomato is like, well, we have this default that will work for everyone so that it just works when people install it. And then, you know, they can go and tweak it and fiddle with it for their specific type of antenna that's attached to the device or whatever. And that gets to a whole different kettle of fish.
Of course, then the fun part is that the numbers that the OEMs are trying to tune those devices for in the first place are usually not numbers that you get by doing a good job of simulating a busy home network. It's, you know, this simple, just throw a single laptop and a speed test at it and call it a day that they expect most of the websites doing the reviews will do. That's what they're trying to game. And so that's where it can kind of go the other way around, where somebody has just absolutely gamed the crap out of their performance, trying to hit that benchmark for the highest number possible. And they've left real world experience, you know, kind of off to the wayside. So in some cases, you know, you can find a win there. But to be clear, when I was talking about third-party firmware rarely being a win, I was already talking about wired networking. Once you bring in Wi-Fi and you bring in the specter that the third parties usually don't have access directly to, you know, the firmware of the chipset that the OEMs frequently have negotiated a license to, that starts getting real iffy. I pretty much would never recommend third-party Wi-Fi firmware.
Right, well, we better get out of here then. Remember, show@2.5admins.com if you want to send any questions or your feedback. You can find me at joelrest.com/mastodon.
You can find me at mercenarysysadmin.com.
And I'm at Alan Jude.
We'll see you next week.